supporting our brothers and sisters in Gaza. Jordanian and Arab artists stand in solidarity with the people of Gaza and Lebanon.
Certainly the tragedy unfolding in Gaza right now calls for empathy and support from the entire world. As fine artists, our mission is to help the world grasp the depth of suffering endured by our brothers and sisters in Gaza and Lebanon. We express this tragedy in the way we know best, through our art.
Released Palestinian prisoner Isra Jabis attended as the guest of honor, showcasing several of her own artworks and introducing her debut book in pain. Her presence highlighted the vital role of art in expressing solidarity with just causes.
Powerful messages are conveyed through each painting. One piece of art reflects my own pain as Isra Jabis, while another tells the story of a Palestinian woman during the war who was exposed to toxic fumes and gave birth to a deformed baby.
The participating artists highlighted art's role in expressing empathy for humanitarian struggles, emphasizing that the Jordanian people have always stood in solidarity with Palestine as part of the Arab country's enduring commitment to the Palestinian cause. The exhibition featured 39 diverse paintings reflecting a wide array of artistic styles. Art is a powerful tool for change, delivering important messages to the world. This exhibition highlights the suffering of Gaza's children and calls for international and Arab communities to stand in solidarity. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
UNRWA was founded with the primary aim of addressing the needs of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were forcibly expelled from their homes and villages. Established in 1949, in the aftermath of the Nakba, UNRWA has been pivotal in providing essential services to millions of Palestinian refugees. For over seven decades, it has worked tirelessly to deliver education, healthcare, and social services to refugees in the Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank, and the neighboring countries such as Lebanon and Jordan. Reports indicate that UN staff and warehouses are being directly targeted, leading to damage to two-thirds of the agency's facilities, with a significant increase in displacement and infrastructure destruction. Civilians are increasingly reliant on the agency's limited services. The Israeli regime has recently enacted new laws that make it impossible for UNRWA to operate. This development follows funding cuts to the agency from several countries, including the United States. Critics argue that these actions undermine the humanitarian principles and worsen the suffering of already vulnerable Palestinian population, leading to catastrophic consequences for health, education, and social support in a region already grappling with significant hardships.
In these critical times, and as the dire situation evolves, the fate of UNRWA and its vital services are hanging in the balance, raising urgent questions about the future of the Palestinian refugees and the broader implications for the regional stability. Ghada Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah.
The main market in the city of Khan Yunis, where people come every day in search of food they can afford to satisfy their hunger. Famine has again returned here as Israel continues to block crossings and restrict the entry of aid and basic necessities in the southern parts. This, as Israel repeatedly says, is thus the safe haven for those remaining in the besieged north.
I have been displaced here since May, and let me say that the situation here in the south is no better than in the north. We lack basic needs such as food, flour, and vegetables. Do you see this tomato? I can't even afford this one tomato, as the prices of available items and vegetables are astronomical. We receive no aid as the crossings are closed. It would cost us a fortune to get one decent meal.
With the market shelves and vendors empty except for a few items available at astronomical prices, the Gazans find themselves looking for whatever they can afford to satisfy their hunger, even it was rotten bread.
We were displaced from Jabalia because we were told that the situation here in the south was better. But we have been struggling every day for more than a year in search of food to feed our children. We can barely find any flour to make some bread. I wish we had stayed in the north and never left.
According to the United Nations World Food Programme, the ongoing crisis could escalate into famine. But Gazans say this is the least that could be said to describe the situation here. What is happening is systematic starvation to kill those who survive the bombardments.
My son asked this morning to make him some salad. Can you imagine? He just asked for a salad, and I couldn't fulfill his wish because we can't afford vegetables. They are scarce and extremely expensive. I own this vendor, but there is nothing to sell because products are banned and people can't afford what is available. And they certainly do not receive aid as Israel prevents it.
Whether in the north of Gaza or here in the south, Palestinians continue to struggle to secure a decent meal for their children. This daily suffering persists while Israel's genocides claim their lives without allowing them the dignity of dying without hunger. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Yemen's naval forces are creating their own parting of the Red Sea to help liberate Palestinians from Israel's genocide in Gaza. The maritime divide by Yemen aims to block vessels linked to Israel while allowing those without ties pass unhindered. According to military officials, Israeli-linked companies are currently trying to fabricate digital data and information to hide their association with Israel so they can pass Yemeni waters.
The Zionists are trying to deceive the world by using unlawful tactics to change the ownership names of vessels and companies associated with them. This will not work. We have enough information, and we know all the names and companies linked to the Zionist entity.
Through advanced data gathering methods, Yemen's ground and naval forces are equipped to take precise actions against vessels engaging in deceptive practices.
Yemen's intelligence and security have reached advanced capabilities. We can obtain any information we want from any source. All information is then submitted to decision makers, who make informed final decisions.
The Red Sea, a strategic yet contested waterway, has become an advantage point for Yemen as they intercept potential threats and block Israeli-linked vessels from advancing undetected. Officials emphasized that fortified naval defenses serve as a crucial line of resistance against covert U.S. and Israeli incursions.
Yemeni territorial waters are considered to be the most strategic yet vulnerable access point the enemy could use against Yemen. Therefore, it was a top priority to advance our naval capabilities, and now these waters have become our strongest weapon, which we are using against the enemy.
Yemen's operations in the Red Sea are specifically aimed at pressuring Israel to end its genocide in Palestine, as well as its military offensive in Lebanon.
Yemen's armed forces say they are now in a stronger position than ever to continue anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea and even beyond. Meanwhile, it seems that Yemen will need to rely more on intelligence gathering in order to continue these calculated naval operations. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terence fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. We know it is rather difficult to move any amount of attention away from Israel's aggression in Lebanon, its systematic attacks on Palestinians in occupied West Bank neighborhoods. It's ruthless 13 months of genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip. For the sake of tonight's program, we have to highlight a genocide within a genocide, a cold, calculated, and unconscionable campaign of siege, massacre, and terror on northern Gaza for over 34 days now. Beit Lahia, Gaza City, and the Jabalia refugee camp. No food, medicine, supplies, or people are allowed in, and anyone who tries to escape is targeted by Israeli occupation forces, sniper fire. The UN humanitarian chief, Joyce Msuya, has warned the Palestinian civilians held under, quote, near total brutal siege by Israeli forces in northern Gaza are starving while the world watches. We'll discuss this and more in today's installment to your Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Case, International Coordinator at the Samidoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver, Canada. And Clive Menzies, researcher and commentator, joining us out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to say hello and welcome to the both of you for joining us on the program. Thank you both. I guess we'll start with you, Charlotte, out there in Vancouver. Just today, over 30 people killed in the Jabalia refugee camp, at least a dozen, and it's still a developing story. Displaced at a school in Beit Lahia, killed mostly women and children in both instances. Your initial thoughts on this U.S.-Israeli war machine continuing its barbarism at this level, which seems also to make it even more grim, no end in sight?
I mean, the Zionist regime has always been genocidal in its nature. It has always been a genocidal project. It's always been a genocidal regime. And the United States, as an imperialist power, along with its fellow imperialist powers, has rushed to give billions and billions of dollars in weaponry to encourage the genocide. I mean, right now in the U.S. elections, despite clear polling data that indicated that the Democratic candidate would be far more popular if she took a stand against the genocide, instead, Kamala Harris, who lost the election, did everything that she could to advocate for more weapons and more money and more bombs to go to the Zionist regime. And so, you know, when we see that this is a genocidal regime that's carrying out a genocidal policy, they are trying to empty the north of Gaza of Palestinians. And these are people in the north of Gaza who have been displaced on multiple occasions, who were ordered to go to the south and told that there would be safety in the south. And then they were bombed and attacked in the south, and who have returned to the north to stay in their homes, to stay on their land, despite the fact that many of them are themselves Palestinian refugees who were expelled from their homes and lands by the Zionist regime during the Nakba in 1947 to 1948. They're refusing ongoing displacement and continuing, therefore, to face this, outright, openly genocidal regime that is openly declaring in the media that it intends to prevent Palestinian civilians from returning to the north of Gaza. And just to be clear, I mean, they have always been outright, this has always been a war on the Palestinian population as a whole. This has been a genocidal aggression which targets homes, schools, places of displacement, mosques, churches, residential buildings. These are the targets of the Zionist regime. They have constantly been the target. They've always had the goal of attempting to seize more Palestinian land and destroying the Palestinian people, and they're continuing to do so. And so it really speaks to the fact that it's urgent for people around the world, particularly in the Imperial Corps, to not sit by and watch this continue to happen after over a year of ongoing genocide, and that it is only the forces of the resistance that are defending and protecting the Palestinian people and upholding their responsibilities under international law, under the Genocide Convention, to stop a genocide that has been taking place and is continuing.
Thank you, Charlotte and Clive. Welcome to the conversation. And I'm glad that Charlotte started with the fact that it's been decades of genocide at different levels, at different degrees, but it's been decades of genocide, ethnic cleansing, different shades of barbarity, but barbarism. But this, your initial thoughts, Clive, because sometimes still, even when you have decades of genocide in front of you, you have certain days where it's still a big punch in the stomach. When you have 30 people, when you have 12 people, when you have, like 3 weeks ago, we had in Beit Lahia, three residential buildings leveled with nearly 80 people, mostly women and children, perishing in one day. It's just really unfathomable, but yet it's happening too frequently for us to really bear.
It is. It's horrific. And one of the sad facts is that when one's exposed to this on a constant basis, and most of this is not seen in Western media, there does become a sort of familiarity with it, which somehow makes it less intense. But when you have the imagination and the understanding of what's actually going on, you cannot help but be revolted. But as I've said many times before, This is, as Charlotte has said, this has been going on for decades, and there is an agenda, and it is an agenda that comes from a structure which is driven by money, but also the ideology of destruction. On one level, this is a land grab, and looking to create pristine cities on the sort of 15-minute city model. But actually, when you look at the reality of what's been happening over the last 70-odd years, it is actually something much deeper than that. And one of the justifications for all this has been this idea that has been inculcated, certainly into Western civilization's psyche, that somehow Israel is exceptional because it suffered such an horrendous atrocity during the Second World War. But the reality is that there is no documentary, physical, or chemical evidence that the narrative of the Holocaust stands up. And one of the facets of this ideology is that it inverts the truth, and it accuses those it accuses others of committing the sort of atrocities that it conducts itself. And if you study the work of the likes of Jurij Lina, who wrote Under the Sign of the Scorpion about the Bolshevik Revolution, there are similar atrocities that were committed in the Russian Revolution. This is something that is almost pathological in its nature. And because we have this mythology of the Holocaust, and you even have so-called Holocaust survivors claiming to be on the side of the Palestinians and being the voice of those who are being oppressed, they are part of the problem, because they continue to perpetuate this narrative of victimhood, which doesn't stand up to any sort of scrutiny. And that is, if you like, the narrative of the Holocaust is the linchpin that actually holds this structure together. And this is not anti-Semitic, or it is not criticizing Jews, because they have been victims. They've been victims of the same pathological structure that has wrapped Jews around itself in order to protect itself. So you need to unwrap these layers for the benefit of Jews. And we need openness as to, one, what has happened in history, and two, what is currently happening. And what is happening now is clearly abhorrent. And there were similar atrocities committed across Germany with the firebombing of Belsen and of Dresden and other cities, which were never actually fully disclosed in the aftermath of the war, that there was recognition to some extent, but they were doing the same on behalf of the same ideology, the same sort of atrocities against women and children and those seeking to escape the atrocities. There were similar atrocities undertaken. And so this is something that has been going on for a long, long time. And it's time for the world to wake up, one, to the reality of this ideology, and two, realize that this is not an exceptional situation in terms of what's been done over centuries.
Right, Clive, thanks. And Kate, Charlotte, I called you Kate, Charlotte Kate, pardon, Charlotte. And I want to put what Clive said to you. I mean, if Israelis enjoy that exceptionalism, and I'm not going to go personally as far as, doubting the accuracy of Holocaust facts. Maybe Clive has been privy or abreast of some historical facts that I may have eluded me, and I'll accept that. But nevertheless, if it's granted that exceptionalism, does that mean it does not have to abide by any rules of engagement, any red lines for its violence, any care or compassion for women, for children, for non-combatant men, for elderly, for the sick?
So let's be very clear. The Nazi apologia aside, which really has nothing to do with the Palestinian cause and is an attempt to hijack the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian struggle to justify one faction of European imperialism from the early 20th century, the fact is that the Zionist Project has always been sponsored and supported by the imperialist powers. I mean, first by Britain, which issued the Balfour Declaration, because the Zionist Project has always been interested in being an outpost for these imperialist powers in the region, and throughout occupied Palestine, not just to attack the Palestinian people, but to essentially enable imperialist powers to continue to confiscate the wealth, resources, and labor power of the people of the Arab and Iranian region consistently in order to deny them self-determination and their future. So therefore, right now, the Zionist regime and its imperialist backers, they're willing to provide billions and billions and billions of dollars in weaponry, not to stop the genocide, not to halt it in its tracks, but to enable it to continue. The fact is that the Palestinian resistance, along with all the resistance forces in the region, has presented a clear challenge to imperialist domination in occupied Palestine and throughout the region. The resistance forces from Palestine to Lebanon to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Iran are confronting imperialism on the front lines, are confronting the attacks and the really just the most brutal forms of destruction, the burning of women and children alive, the rape and sexual assault of prisoners who have been captured, just the most horrific forms of violence against the Palestinian people. This is being paid for and sponsored because they view it as beneficial to them. And so therefore, it's only the resistance forces that are acting in a meaningful way to put a stop to this genocidal policy. These imperialist powers are not just standing by and letting it happen. They're sending them the bombs and the money in order for it to continue.
Right. And Clive, why does it seem the international community does not mobilize to do more? Why are they not moved by the atrocities in Gaza, even when you get really just astronomical numbers in one day that really turn most people's hearts and guts and souls? France said we're going to stop sending arms to Israel. They didn't. Spain said we're going to stop sending arms to Israel. We find out they didn't. Berlin said they're going to cut down. We see they really didn't. So, I mean, we get a lot of this double talk, but no one really takes any concrete action. We don't see sanctions. We don't see anything that will curb the regime's atrocities. Why?
I fear that the connection is not as good as it should be, but hopefully this will get through. I mean, essentially, one needs to understand who actually controls the power. And the power is controlled by those who control money. And to talk about the imperial project, there was the, if you like, the Anglo-American establishment, which which came into being at the turn of the 20th century under Cecil Rhodes and his acolytes, that is effectively funded by the same sources that are funding the current genocide. And essentially, the Balfour Declaration was given to the Rothschilds in exchange for getting the US into the First World War. So all of the international organizations that you refer to, plus most of the Western governments, are under the same sort of power. So I've had a number of discussions where people suggest that Israel is, if you like, the imperial project of America in the Middle East. But actually, the reverse is true. American Congress is dominated by the same forces. You don't get into Congress unless you get the sanction of the Jewish/Israeli lobby, who effectively can remove people from power very easily. And this has been going on for a long, long time. So this, although the public face of imperialism may appear to be British, as it was in the first half of the 20th century, or American since then, this is actually the same ideology expressed through what seems to be different forms of cosmetic front, for want of a better way of putting it. So in terms of where we go from here, the essential thing to remember is that we vote for our governments, and the whole business of election is in a distraction. And so the American election has been distracting opinion whilst this has been going on. But nothing is going to change under that. The only way things are going to change is when we stop paying our taxes, paying our rents, complying with the laws that make no sense to any of us, and withdraw from these structures that are actually conducting a war on us all, not just in Palestine, although obviously that's the most graphic and horrific expression of it, but it's going on everywhere through mass vaccination, through chemtrails and poisoning people, through our food, through so many vectors. We are the victims of this, the people of the world, and it is the power structure that is perpetuating this. And the only way that this will stop is when we cease to support that power structure. But it's going to take considerable sort of enlightenment of more and more people, which is happening, albeit slowly, to realize that most of what we think we know actually doesn't withstand scrutiny. Hence my reference to the propaganda that was propagated through the Second World War is a repeat of what started in the First World War. So you have to understand 20th century history in order to understand what's going on now, and realize that there is a direct connect between the structure and the results, which is this atrocity, because the existing structure will not alleviate this. And it's not surprising that the international community says one thing and yet does another, because the structure forces them to.
Thank you, Clive. And Charlotte, at this point, I'm sure the Palestinians in northern Gaza, they care little for reparations or justice or accountability. They just want this nightmare to stop. They want their kids to eat. They want to stop having their buildings shake and tremble through the night because of sounds of bombs and their children crying throughout the... I mean, what do we do for them? How do we comfort them, give them any sense of security, give them any sense of hope?
So on a basic level, that's true, right? Like Palestinians, like all other people, like all other humans, if they're being contended with this murderous force, this like absolutely really evil, horrific force that's just engaging in the most blatant and horrific forms of atrocities, that is just raining death and destruction wherever it can at any moment. Obviously, the most basic need that people have is to survive, to eat, to have a place to live, to have health care. And of course, we've seen the deliberate destruction and targeting of hospitals. We're seeing the deliberate destruction and targeting of schools. These are part and parcel of the genocide, to deny Palestinians access to health care, to education, to these basic aspects of like being able to sustain the society. So of course, people at a very basic level, they just want this to stop. At the same time, the Palestinian people in northern Gaza, throughout Gaza and throughout Palestine, and in exile and diaspora, have also been very clear that demanding that this stop immediately is not a precursor to accepting surrender. And it's actually a kind of courage and bravery that really everybody should just like kind of stop and respect with like an immense awe, because the fact is that Palestinians have not given up on actual change, on actual accountability, on actually bringing the Zionist regime to justice. I mean, they might not be concerned with the next case that's going to be filed in international court, but there is a fundamental refusal to surrender and a refusal to give up and a refusal to stop the resistance despite all of the crimes and despite all of the massacres. And what that has to speak to us to do is to step up everything that we're doing, to escalate our campaigns, to escalate our struggle, because if we are going out and protesting in the streets, this is important to show our dissent, but it's not enough. It's not sufficient so long as the war machine of imperialism is continuing to move forward. When we're seeing things happening like the actions of Palestine Action demonstrators in Britain, who have actually shut down several facilities of Elbit Systems, this Zionist war machine manufacturer, those are incredible actions that are, you know, actually bringing a material stop to the war machine. When we're seeing the actions of activists in Spain and internationally who are making sure that ships carrying military equipment, or in Turkey, get that ships carrying military equipment to the Zionist regime get blocked, this is small in comparison to what we see Yemen doing, shutting down the supply lines of genocide in the Red Sea. But it is a material method of participating in the struggle and not allowing these crimes to continue to happen, because we can't sit back and watch. We have to take an active role, especially in the heart of the Imperial Core, where these crimes are being planned, funded, and organized and armed.
And Clive, earlier, thank you for that, Charlotte. Clive, earlier, Charlotte, she referenced U.S. Elections. My question to you, many say when it comes to Israel or it comes to the Palestinians, what we have seen as of late, nothing will change under a Trump presidency. But many argue that, in fact, they feel things will get much worse as Netanyahu basically sees the region of West Asia through Netanyahu's lenses, because he knows very little about historical facts and the region. How do you see a Trump presidency impacting this genocide in Gaza?
Well, I've been asked on a couple of occasions what effect the U.S. election would have, and I don't see that a change of president will in any way change the trajectory that the world is on at the moment, not least because Trump, far more visibly than any other American president, is a self-declared supporter of Israel. He has fully endorsed this idea that Hamas must be destroyed. But when the subtext is that Hamas is basically any male is identified as Israel as being Hamas, then the extension of that, or the logical conclusion of that, is that all Palestinians must be destroyed. So I'm not in any way hopeful that a change of presidency is going to change anything. Charlotte referred to Spain and other countries that are in some way seeking to give out the message that this is not acceptable. And whilst the UN and the international bodies that I referred to earlier have been impotent or even complicit in what's been going on over the last 70 years, it's quite notable that I think her name is Francesca Albanese, who's a special rapporteur on the Palestinian plight, for want of a better way of putting it. She's been quite outspoken. But I think it is incumbent on media throughout the world and anyone with any sort of voice to actually start dealing in reality. And I understand that people in European countries, to in any way question the facts of the Holocaust, is illegal. Now, the truth does not need a law to enforce it, and therefore, why is it illegal? And so many people are terrified of discussing this because of the repercussions. But we need to get to the truth of the reality in which we come from in terms of 20th century history and how this is extended and exacerbating what's going on now. Because otherwise this will not stop.
I want to thank you both for...
Greater Israel is the ambition, and that's what they've been working for ever since long before 1948.
Thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. Charlotte Cates joining us out of Vancouver, Canada, and Clive Menzies there joining us out of London, the UK. Viewers, this brings us to the end of this segment, your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
The Limelight.
Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has blamed President Joe Biden for Democrats' defeat in the elections. Nancy Pelosi said, had Biden left sooner, the Democratic Party could have had an open primary. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Joe Biden's slowness in exiting the 2024 presidential election cost the Democrats dearly, the former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi emphasized just days after Kamala Harris was beaten by Donald Trump. Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said, "We live with what happened." Pelosi was speaking to The Interview, a New York Times podcast, in a conversation the newspaper said would be published on Saturday. Had President Biden gotten out sooner, Pelosi remarked, there may have been other candidates in the race. The anticipation was that if the president were to step aside, that there would be an open primary. Pelosi added, as I say, Kamala may have, and I think she would have done very well in that and been stronger going forward, but we just don't know. That didn't happen. We live with what happened, and because the president endorsed Kamala Harris immediately, that really made it almost impossible to have an open primary at that time. If it had been much earlier, it would have been different. As Democrats engaged in bitter blame games over Kamala Harris's defeat and a second presidency for Donald Trump, who senior Democrats from Kamala Harris down freely called a fascist, Nancy Pelosi's words landed like an explosive shell. The New York Times said Pelosi went to great lengths to defend the Biden administration's legislative accomplishments, most of which took place during the first 2 years when she was the Speaker of the House. Republicans took the House in 2022. Pelosi, now 84 years old, was re-elected this week to a 20th two-year term. Joe Biden was 78 years old when elected in 2020 and is now just short of 82 years old. He long rejected doubts about his continued capacity for office, but they exploded into the open after a calamitous first debate against Donald Trump in last June. On 21st of July, the president took the historic decision to step aside as a Democratic nominee. Within minutes, though, he had endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, to replace him. Nancy Pelosi reportedly played a key role in persuading Joe Biden to stand aside, but she has not sought to soothe his feelings. In August, she told the New Yorker magazine she had never been that impressed with his political operation. Pelosi added, "They won the White House, bravo, but my concern was, this ain't happening, and we have to make a decision for this to happen. The president has to make the decision for that to happen." Joe Biden is widely reported to be furious with the former speaker. This week, reports have said the president and his senior staffers are furious with Barack Obama, under whom Joe Biden served as vice president, but who also helped push Biden to drop out of the re-election race. According to the New York Times, Nancy Pelosi also rejected comments from Bernie Sanders, in which the independent senator from Vermont said Donald Trump won because Democrats had abandoned working-class Americans. Remarks the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison, called total nonsense. Nancy Pelosi added, "Bernie Sanders has not won. With all due respect, and I have a great deal of respect for him, for what he stands for, but I don't respect him saying that the Democratic Party has abandoned the working-class families." According to Pelosi, cultural factors pushed Americans to vote for Donald Trump. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in portions of a New York Times podcast interview published on Friday, blamed Vice President Kamala Harris's election loss on President Joe Biden's late exit from the presidential race and the lack of Democratic primary. Nancy Pelosi told Lulu Garcia Navarro, a host of the interview, that had the President Biden gotten out sooner, there may have been other candidates in the primary race. Pelosi added, the anticipation was that if President Biden were to step aside, that there would be an open primary. She added, and I say Kamala Harris may have, I think she would have done very well in that and been stronger going forward. But we don't know that. That didn't happen. We live with what happened. And because the president endorsed Kamala Harris immediately, that really made it almost impossible to have a primary at that time. If it had been much earlier, it would have been very different. As ABC News has reported, Nancy Pelosi worked behind the scenes to urge Joe Biden to drop out of the presidential race following his performance at CNN's televised debate with Donald Trump. Back in November of 2022, when ABC's This Week co-anchor George Stephanopoulos asked Pelosi, "Do you think that President Biden should run again?" she answered, "Yes, I do. I mean, President Biden has been a great president for our country. He has accomplished so much." The New York Times reported that Pelosi also took issue with independent Senator Bernie Sanders, saying, after Kamala Harris's loss, that it should come as no surprise because the Democratic Party has abandoned working-class Americans and would find the working-class Americans have abandoned them. Nancy Pelosi commented on Bernie Sanders by saying, "Bernie Sanders has not won, with all due respect, and I have a great deal of respect for him for what he stands for, but I don't respect him saying the Democratic Party has abandoned working-class American families." The New York Times reported she suggested that cultural issues were more to blame for Democrats' losses among working-class voters.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hezbollah's missiles and drones continue to pound Israeli military bases and settlements in the occupied territories in retaliation for the regime's aggression against Lebanon. Hamas calls for the formation of an international Arab and Islamic alliance to end Israel's aggression against Gaza and Lebanon. And Iran calls for the expulsion of Israel from the United Nations after the regime's latest airstrikes in Syria kills and injures dozens of civilians. Thank you for joining us. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has carried out more retaliatory operations against Israeli targets in support of Palestinians in Gaza and in defense of Lebanon and its people. A number of Israeli settlements were targeted in the attacks. They include Evan Menachem and Shtula that were hit with barrages of rockets. Some gatherings of Israeli soldiers were targeted with drones as well. A squadron of drones also struck the Haifa naval base and the Nawara base in the northern occupied Palestinian territories. Hezbollah fired rockets towards the regime's Avital site in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights too. The resistance fighters clashed with invading Israeli forces in the Lebanese town of Eit Arun, leaving casualties amongst the regime's troops. The death toll from the Israeli war on Lebanon keeps rising as the regime continues to pound the Arab country indiscriminately with air and artillery strikes. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh gave us more details. Let's take a listen.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you mentioned, of course, the very bloody massacre that Lebanon woke up to today. And this is one of the usual when it comes for the Israelis. Before, the Israelis were targeting unexpected areas. They still are. But, of course, now it has become very difficult to really know where the Israelis will strike. And so the Israelis went to all the way to Almat, which is in the Jbeil district. This is quite far away from any confrontation area, and we know that those people who were targeted were all displaced from the area of Bekaa. And this is perhaps one of the bloodiest massacres committed by the Israelis. You mentioned 23 martyrs, but the authorities are saying there are probably still people under the rubble, or at least remnants of bodies that the authorities need to, of course, test to know the exact numbers of martyrs. You mentioned three in the Qasr area as well. And the issue with Al-Qasr, this is a very far town, and it was very difficult up until now, we know, for ambulances or rescue teams to reach the area and to see, of course, and search for